Chapter 9. The Rate of Surplus Value. Section 1. The Degree of Exploitation of Labour Power. The surplus value generated in the process of production by the capital advanced, or in other words, the self-expansion of the value of the capital, presents itself for our consideration in the first place as a surplus, as the amount by which the value of the product exceeds the value of its constituent elements. The capital is made up of two components, one the sum of money laid out upon the means of production, and the other the sum of money expended upon the labour power, respectively the portion that has become constant capital and the portion that has become variable capital. At first, then, capital advanced equals constant capital plus variable capital. For example, if £500 is the capital advanced, its components may be such that the £500 equals £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital. When the process of production is finished, we get a commodity whose value equals constant capital plus variable capital plus S, where S is the surplus value. Or taking our former figures, the value of the commodity may be £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus. The original capital has now changed from capital advanced to incremented capital, from £500 to £590. The difference is S, or a surplus value of £90. Since the value of the constituent elements of the product is equal to the value of the advanced capital, it is mere tautology to say that the excess of the value of the product over the value of its constituent elements is equal to the expansion of the capital advanced, or to the surplus value produced. Nevertheless, we must examine this tautology a little more closely. The two things compared are the value of the product and the value of its constituents consumed in the process of production. Now we have seen how that portion of the constant capital, which consists of the instruments of labour, transfers to the production only a fraction of its value, while the remainder of that value continues to reside in those instruments. Since this remainder plays no part in the formation of value, we may at present leave it on one side. To introduce it into the calculation would make no difference. For instance, taking our former example, constant capital equals £410. Suppose this sum to consist of £312 value of raw material, £44 value of auxiliary material, and £54 value of the machinery worn away in the process. And suppose that the total value of the machinery employed is £1,054. Out of this latter sum, then, we reckon, as advance for the purpose of turning out the product, the sum of £54 alone, which the machinery loses by wear and tear in the process, for this is all it parts with to the product. Now, if we also reckon the remaining £1,000, which still continues in the machinery, as transferred to the product, we ought also to reckon it as part of the value advanced, and thus make it appear on both sides of our calculation. Footnote. If we reckon the value of the fixed capital employed as part of the advances, we must reckon the remaining value of such capital at the end of the year as a part of the annual returns. Malthus, Principles of Political Economy, 1836. End of footnote. We should, in this way, get £1,500 on one side and £1,590 on the other. The difference of these two sums, or the surplus value, would still be £90. Throughout this book, therefore, by constant capital advanced for the production of value, we always mean unless the context is repugnant thereto, the value of the means of production actually consumed in the process, and that value alone. This being so, let us return to the formula capital advanced equals constant capital plus variable capital, which we saw was transformed into incremented capital, equals constant capital plus variable capital plus S, capital advanced becoming incremented capital. We know that the value of the constant capital is transferred to and merely reappears in the product. The new value actually created in the process, the value produced or value product, is therefore not the same as the value of the product. It is not, as it would at first sight appear, constant capital plus variable capital plus S, or £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value, but variable capital plus S, or £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value, not £590, but £180. If constant capital equals zero, or in other words, if there were branches of industry in which the capitalist could dispense with all means of production made by previous labour, whether they be raw material, auxiliary material, or instruments of labour, employing only labour power and materials supplied by nature, in that case, there would be no constant capital to transfer to the product. This component of the value of the product, that is, the £410 in our example, would be eliminated, but the sum of £180, the amount of new value created, or the value produced, which contains £90 of surplus value, would remain just as great as if constant capital represented the highest value imaginable. We should have capital advanced equals zero plus variable capital equals variable capital, or incremented capital, the expanded capital, equals variable capital plus S, and therefore incremented capital minus capital advanced equals S as before. On the other hand, if S equals zero, or in other words, if the labour power, whose value is advanced in the form of variable capital, were to produce only its equivalent, we should have capital advanced equals constant capital plus variable capital, or incremented capital, the value of the product, equals constant capital plus variable capital plus zero, or capital advanced equals incremented capital. The capital advanced would, in this case, not have expanded its value. From what has gone before, we know that surplus value is purely the result of a variation in the value of variable capital, of that portion of the capital which is transformed into labour power. Consequently, variable capital plus S equals variable capital plus an increment of variable capital. But the fact is that it is variable capital alone that varies, and the conditions of that variation are obscured by the circumstance that in consequence of the increase in the variable component of the capital, there is also an increase in the sum total of the advanced capital. It was originally £500 and becomes £590. Therefore, in order that our investigation may lead to accurate results, we must make abstraction from that portion of the value of the product in which constant capital alone appears, and consequently must equate the constant capital to zero. This is merely an application of a mathematical rule, employed whenever we operate with constant and variable magnitudes related to each other by the symbols of addition and subtraction only. A further difficulty is caused by the original form of the variable capital. In our example, incremented capital equals £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value. But £90 is a given, and therefore a constant quantity. Hence it appears absurd to treat it as a variable. But in fact the term £90 variable is here merely a symbol to show that this value undergoes a process. The portion of the capital invested in the purchase of labour power is a definite quantity of materialised labour, a constant value like the value of the labour power purchased. But in the process of production, the place of the £90 is taken by the labour power in action. Dead labour is replaced by living labour. Something stagnant by something flowing, a constant by a variable. The result is the reproduction of variable capital plus an increment. From the point of view, then, of capitalist production, the whole process appears as the spontaneous variation of the originally constant value, which is transformed into labour power. Both the process and its result appear to be owing to this value. If, therefore, such expressions as £90 variable capital or so much self-expanding value appear contradictory, this is only because they bring to the surface a contradiction immanent in capitalist production. At first sight, it appears a strange proceeding to equate the constant capital to zero. Yet it is what we do every day. If, for example, we wish to calculate the amount of England's profits from the cotton industry, we first of all deduct the sums paid for cotton to the United States, India, Egypt, and other countries. In other words, the value of the capital that merely reappears in the value of the product is put equal to zero. Of course, the ratio of surplus value, not only to that portion of the capital from which it immediately springs and whose change of values it represents, but also to the sum total of the capital advanced, is economically of very great importance. We shall, therefore, in the third book, treat of this ratio exhaustively. In order to enable one portion of a capital to expand its value by being converted into labour power, it is necessary that another portion be converted into means of production. In order that variable capital may perform its function, constant capital must be advanced in proper proportion, a proportion given by the special technical conditions of each labour process. The circumstance, however, that retorts and other vessels are necessary to a chemical process does not compel the chemist to notice them in the result of his analysis. If we look at the means of production in their relation to the creation of value and to the variation in the quantity of value, apart from anything else, they appear simply as the material in which labour power, the value creator, incorporates itself. Neither the nature nor the value of this material is of any importance. The only requisite is that there be a sufficient supply to absorb the labour expended in the process of production. That supply once given, the material may rise or fall in value, or even be, as land and the sea, without any value in itself. But this will have no influence on the creation of value, or on the variation in the quantity of value. Footnote. What Lucretius says is self-evident. Nil posse creare de nihilo. Out of nothing, nothing can be created. Creation of value is transformation of labour power into labour. Labour power itself is energy transferred to a human organism by means of nourishing matter. End of footnote. In the first place, then, we equate the constant capital to zero. The capital advanced is consequently reduced from constant capital plus variable capital to variable capital. And instead of the value of the product, constant capital plus variable capital plus S, we have now the value produced. variable capital plus S. Given the new value produced equals £180, which sum consequently represents the whole labour expended during the process, then subtracting from it £90, the value of the variable capital, we have remaining £90, the amount of the surplus value. This sum of £90, or S, expresses the absolute quantity of surplus value produced. The relative quantity produced, or the increase percent, of the variable capital is determined, it is plain, by the ratio of the surplus value to the variable capital, or is expressed by S over V, where V is the variable capital. In our example, this ratio is 90 over 90, which gives an increase of 100%. This relative increase in the value of the variable capital, or the relative magnitude of the surplus value, I call the rate of surplus value. Footnote. In the same way that the English use the terms rate of profit, rate of interest. We shall see in Book 3 that the rate of profit is no mystery so soon as we know the laws of surplus value. If we reverse the process, we cannot comprehend either the one or the other. End of footnote. We have seen that the labourer, during one portion of the labour process, produces only the value of his labour power, that is, the value of his means of subsistence. Now, since his work forms part of a system based on the social division of labour, he does not directly produce the actual necessaries which he himself consumes. He produces instead a particular commodity, yarn, for example, whose value is equal to the value of those necessaries or of the money with which they can be bought. The portion of his day's labour devoted to this purpose will be greater or less in proportion to the value of the necessaries that he daily requires on an average, or, what amounts to the same thing, in proportion to the labour time required on an average to produce them. If the value of those necessaries represent on an average the expenditure of 6 hours' labour, the workman must on average work for 6 hours to produce that value. If instead of working for the capitalist he worked independently on his own account, he would, other things being equal, still be obliged to labour for the same number of hours in order to produce the value of his labour power, and thereby to gain the means of subsistence necessary for his conservation or continued reproduction. But as we have seen, during that portion of his day's labour in which he produces the value of his labour power, say 3 shillings, he produces only an equivalent for the value of his labour power already advanced by the capitalist. Footnote. Note added in the 3rd German edition. The author resorts here to the economic language in current use. It will be remembered that it was shown that in reality the labourer advances to the capitalist, and not the capitalist to the labourer. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. The new value created only replaces the variable capital advanced. It is owing to this fact that the production of the new value of 3 shillings takes the semblance of a mere reproduction. That portion of the working day, then, during which this reproduction takes place, I call necessary labour time, and the labour expended during that time I call necessary labour. Footnote. In this work we have, up to now, employed the term necessary labour time to designate the time necessary under given social conditions for the production of any commodity. Henceforward, we use it to designate also the time necessary for the production of the particular commodity by labour power. The use of one and the same technical term in different senses is inconvenient, but in no science can it be altogether avoided. Compare, for instance, the higher with the lower branches of mathematics. End of footnote. necessary as regards the labourer because independent of the particular social form of his labour, necessary as regards capital and the world of capitalists because on the continued existence of the labourer depends their existence also. During the second period of the labour process, that in which his labour is no longer necessary labour, the workman, it is true, labours, expends labour power, but his labour, being no longer necessary labour, he creates no value for himself. He creates surplus value, which for the capitalist has all the charms of a creation out of nothing. This portion of the working day I name surplus labour time, and to the labour expended during that time I give the name of surplus labour. It is every bit as important for a correct understanding of surplus value to conceive it as a mere congelation of surplus labour time, as nothing but materialised surplus labour, as it is for a proper comprehension of value to conceive it as a mere congelation of so many hours of labour, as nothing but materialised labour. The essential difference between the various economic forms of society, between, for instance, a society based on slave labour and one based on wage labour, lies only in the mode in which this surplus labour is in each case extracted from the actual producer, the labourer. Footnote. Herr Wilhelm Thucydides Roche has found a mare's nest. He has made the important discovery that if, on the one hand, the formation of surplus value, or surplus produce, and the consequent accumulation of capital is nowadays due to the thrift of the capitalist, on the other hand, in the lowest stages of civilization, it is the strong who compel the weak to economize. To economize what? Labor or superfluous wealth that does not exist? What is it that makes such men as Roche account for the origin of surplus value by a mere réchauffé of the more or less plausible excuses by the capitalist for his appropriation of surplus value? It is, besides their real ignorance, their apologetic dread of a scientific analysis of value and surplus value, and of obtaining a result possibly not altogether palatable to the powers that be. End of footnote. Since, on the one hand, the values of the variable capital and of the labour power purchased by that capital are equal, and the value of this labour power determines the necessary portion of the working day, and since, on the other hand, the surplus value is determined by the surplus portion of the working day, it follows that surplus value, S, bears the same ratio to variable capital, V, that surplus labour does to necessary labour. Or, in other words, the rate of surplus value, S over V, equals surplus labour over necessary labour. Both ratios, S over V and surplus labour over necessary labour, express the same thing in different ways. In the one case, by reference to the materialised incorporated labour, in the other, by reference to living, fluent labour. The rate of surplus value is therefore an exact expression for the degree of exploitation of labour power by capital, or of the labourer by the capitalist. Footnote. Although the rate of surplus value is an exact expression for the degree of exploitation of labour power, it is in no sense an expression for the absolute amount of exploitation. For example, if the necessary labour equals 5 hours, and the surplus labour equals 5 hours, the degree of exploitation is 100%. The amount of exploitation is here measured by 5 hours. If, on the other hand, the necessary labour equals 6 hours, and the surplus labour equals 6 hours, the degree of exploitation remains, as before, 100%, while the actual amount of exploitation has increased 20%, namely from 5 hours to 6. End of footnote. We assumed in our example that the value of the product equals £410 constant capital plus £90 variable capital plus £90 surplus value, and that the capital advanced equaled £500. Since the surplus value equals £90 and the advanced capital equals £500, we should, according to the usual way of reckoning, get as the rate of surplus value, generally confounded with the rate of profits, 18%, a rate so low as possibly to cause a pleasant surprise to Mr. Carey and other harmonizers. But in truth, the rate of surplus value is not equal to surplus over advanced capital, or surplus over constant capital plus variable capital, but to surplus value over variable capital. Thus, it is not 90 over 500, but 90 over 90, or 100%, which is more than 5 times the apparent degree of exploitation. Although, in the case we have supposed, we are ignorant of the actual length of the working day and of the duration in days or weeks of the labour process, as also of the number of labourers employed, yet the rate of surplus value, S over V, accurately discloses to us, by means of its equivalent expression, surplus labour over necessary labour, the relation between the two parts of the working day. This relation is here one of equality, the rate being 100%. Hence, it is plain, the labourer, in our example, works one half of the day for himself, the other half for the capitalist. The method of calculating the rate of surplus value is therefore, shortly, as follows. We take the total value of the product and put the constant capital, which merely reappears in it, equal to zero. What remains is the only value that has, in the process of producing the commodity, been actually created. If the amount of surplus value be given, we have only to deduct it from this remainder to find the variable capital. And vice versa, if the latter be given, and we require to find the surplus value. If both be given, we have only to perform the concluding operation, viz., to calculate S over V, the ratio of the surplus value to the variable capital. Though the method is so simple, yet it may not be amiss, by means of a few examples, to exercise the reader in the application of the novel principles underlying it. First, we will take the case of a spinning mill containing 10,000 mule spindles, spinning number 32 yarn from American cotton, and producing 1 pound of yarn weekly per spindle. We assume the waste to be 6%. Under these circumstances, 10,600 pounds of cotton are consumed weekly, of which 600 pounds go to waste. The price of the cotton in April 1871 was 7¾ per pound. The raw material, therefore, costs, in round numbers, £342. The 10,000 spindles, including preparation machinery and motive power, cost, we will assume, 1 pound per spindle, amounting to a total of 10,000 pounds. The wear and tear we put at 10%, or 1,000 pounds yearly equals 20 pounds weekly. The rent of the building we suppose to be 300 pounds a year, or 6 pounds a week. Coal consumed, for 100 horsepower indicated at 4 pounds of coal per horsepower per hour during 60 hours, and inclusive of that consumed in heating the mill, 11 tons a week, at 8 shillings and sixpence a ton, amounts to about 4½ pounds a week. Gas, 1 pound a week. Oil, etc., 4½ pounds a week. Total cost of the above auxiliary materials, 10 pounds weekly. Therefore, the constant portion of the value of the week's product is 378 pounds. Wages amount to £52 a week. The price of the yarn is 12.25 per pound, which gives for the value of £10,000 the sum of £510. The surplus value is therefore in this case £510 minus £430 equals £80. We put the constant part of the value of the product equal to zero, as it plays no part in the creation of value. There remains £132 as the weekly value created, which equals £52 variable capital plus £80 surplus value. The rate of surplus value is therefore 80 over 52, equals 153.11%. In a working day of 10 hours, with average labour, the result is necessary labour equals 3.31/33 hours, and surplus labour equals 6.23 hours. Footnote. The above data, which may be relied upon, were given me by a Manchester spinner. In England, the horsepower of an engine was formerly calculated from the diameter of its cylinder. Now the actual horsepower shown by the indicator is taken. End of footnote. One more example. Jacob gives the following calculation for the year 1815. Owing to the previous adjustment of several items, it is very imperfect. Nevertheless, for our purpose, it is sufficient. In it, he assumes the price of wheat to be 8 shillings a quarter, and the average yield per acre to be 22 bushels. Assuming that the price of the product is the same as its value, we here find the surplus value distributed under the various heads of profit, interest, rent, etc. We have nothing to do with these in detail, we simply add them together, and the sum is a surplus value of £3.11. The sum of £3.19, paid for seed and manure, is constant capital, and we put it equal to zero. There is left the sum of £3.10, which is the variable capital advanced, and we see that a new value of £3.10 plus £3.11 has been produced in its place. Therefore, S over V equals £3.11 over £3.10, giving a rate of surplus value of more than 100%. The labourer employs more than one half of his working day in producing the surplus value, which different persons, under different pretexts, share amongst themselves. Footnote. The calculations given in the text are intended merely as illustrations. We have, in fact, assumed that prices equals values. We shall, however, see in Book 3 that even in the case of average prices, the assumption cannot be made in this very simple manner. End of footnote.